The next case today is number 221204 and number 221205, United States versus Javier Mojica-Ramos. At this time, would counsel for the appellant please introduce himself on the record to begin?
Good morning, I'm Kevin Larman. Once again, on behalf of Javier Mojica-Ramos, the appellant, may I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes.
May it please the court. Murder, intentional homicide, drug trafficking, a tidal wave of armed violent crime. And to support this and the thesis by the substitute prosecutor at page 60 of the appendix, that the nature of the offense in this case goes beyond the simple possession of a machine gun. According to the government, the danger to the community and the serious nature of the offense should be considered exceptional in this case. What's the government support for this thesis? A digital file dump, over 240 pages long, undated, not biographical to Mr. Mojica, except for some individual pictures of his ID and I think one personal photo in there. This was a substantive request for a significant upward variance. It wasn't justified by any countervailing obligation that the government possessed. And it's a symptom of really a similar type of error as going all the way back to Santabella, where you have a new prosecutor come in late in the case. Apparently the left hand is not talking to the right, as Santabella explained it. And the new prosecutor was handed by the U.S. Attorney's Office essentially a weapon that can be used for an upward variance. We've provided the court and we provided the district court below numerous examples of how the government uses this type of argument, this type of material, to make a substantive request, either explicitly or implicitly, for an upwardly variant sentence. The government essentially undermined its promise to recommend a sentence within the 37 to 46 month range.
I just want to ask you a narrow question, which is, I think one of your arguments is that the government's conduct in advocating for a high-end revocation sentence should also be considered as part of its breach of the plea agreement in the 922-0 charge. Do I have that right?
I'm sorry, their conduct in advocating for it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think that the main breach was the filing of this memorandum and then attacking the defense memorandum essentially baselessly, his family
yes.
History, his Catholic faith.
Specifically though, so are there cases suggesting that the government's statements at the revocation sentence then could also be imputed as the prosecutorial breach if the revocation sentence wasn't contemplated by the plea agreement?
As far as a case that expressly does that and saw this type of conduct where the government essentially, you know, laundered a breach into the revocation hearing, no. What the court has to look to is general contract principles, and the government can't undermine the benefit of the bargain in this case.
Did you bargain for a benefit on the supervised release recommendation?
It wasn't expressly in
no.
The, but we did waive, so one of the operative factors in enforcing an agreement is the waiver of a constitutional right, necessarily required waiver of the revocation hearing, of the violation portion of that hearing, and a lot of this we address in our reply. The duty of good faith and fair dealings required the government not to undermine the benefit of the bargain in any case.
Is this the case where your brief said that you were denied the sentence you were entitled to?
If it said exactly that language, then I
know I've read that this week, and
it was the recommendation.
Unbelievably wrong.
It was we were denied the recommendation that yes. We were entitled to.
No, maybe not, but okay.
Counsel, is your breach claim for the revocation sentence, is that subject to plain error? Do you agree with that?
I don't, Your Honor. When we filed the motion to compel performance, we asked that both these cases be changed to a different judge so that specific performance could be ordered. And that flows, regardless of how the court looks at the breach, the court looks at Kirkuler, the Kirkuler case of this circuit, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but that case says the government is not entitled to breach and cause a plea to be vacated. So it can't be that the only way that we get due process in the revocation is to ask to vacate our plea. Because we could have, courts generally say that the defendant can request either vacature of the plea, which is what happened recently in Arce Ayala, slightly different issue, but it was an issue with the understanding of the plea terms, or specific performance, and you can't order specific performance without including the revocation. And then we incorporated our objections into the revocation portion of the proceedings. And especially when the injury from the breach necessarily caused another injury. And so I think in the contract law, the duty to mitigate comes into play. And the government had that duty and breached that.
What about, here's another question. Can you point us to anywhere in the record where it makes clear that the district court actually relied on the images in the sentence? And I understand that might not be necessary for your breach claim, but it seems relevant for the other claims that you're bringing. And I'm just wondering if there's anything in the record where it's clear that you in fact relied on these images.
Sure. So my first answer is I can't point to part of the record where the judge says, I saw all these images and I'm giving a higher sentence. I think that it's apparent from the court sentence, from how it tracked the government's arguments, the government's substantive arguments, and I think it's apparent from the state of the law. If the court assumes otherwise that the district court followed the law, we've cited authority that shows that sentencing memoranda are meant to influence the court's decision. And so this court has this principle that says the court can infer a district court decision based on what the parties argued. So I think there's abundant material, even the use of the word arsenal, and then looking to the government's memorandum, which it wasn't just photos attached, they were embedded within the memorandum to support the court thesis, which was improper, which was in this case exceptional, and exceptional sentences are not guideline sentences.
Mr. Lord, let me ask you briefly. This is a plea agreement that left a fair amount of room for advocacy by both sides, correct?
I don't understand the question. I'm sorry.
By my count, the defense recommendation was going to be 36 months on the possession and 24 months on the supervised release, for a total of 60, right? And the government was going to agree to recommend 77 months total, 47 on the possession and 30 on the supervised release, right?
So, I think that would be incorrect. The agreement is for a guideline recommendation. So,
but the guidelines left that much room, correct? As between the possession offense and the supervised release. The government was free to argue for the high end, and you were free to recommend the low end, correct?
In theory, correct, as long as we got the benefit of our bargain. So
well, let's talk about what you agreed to. What you agreed to was a guideline recommendation by both sides. The that still left a fair amount of room for disagreement, judgment, and advocacy, correct?
It's a very small amount of room, even if the court thinks there's a separate.
We're being told in many other cases this week that a 12-month increase over a guideline range is huge, colossal, gargantuan. This is a 17-month range. It's a significant amount of choice. There's a lot of room for advocacy. My problem that I hope you will address is how we phrase a workable rule that allows both sides to advocate within the scope of the agreement, and that does not silence the government from advocacy that is permitted under the agreement. This court has said before, the government doesn't have to pull punches on this, even when there's an agreement. I heard you say a moment ago in response to one of my colleagues' questions that you thought that the government's criticism of your client's arguments in mitigation in response to the sentencing memorandum was itself a breach. And I'm having trouble figuring out how there's a workable rule here and how we write an opinion.
Sure. Well, two responses. The workable rule depends on whether an impartial observer would see the government's conduct and believe that the government believes that a sentence in the guideline range for their recommended sentence is appropriate. And that requires a range of context. In this court, leading up to the sentencing hearing, we had a pre-sentence report that suggested reasons for an upward variance. We had the district court holding up Narvaez Soto, a very significant upward variance, and saying that the government's material, there wasn't an issue with it. So the government goes in there with the context, and that's a significant part of what makes the government's recommendation excessive. And regardless of what broader, I think this might be a case that's difficult to make a broader rule, because the government is so far outside of what a substantive submission could be, which is why we submitted some cases showing that when the government is looking at a nonviolent offense and characterizes the defendant as a sociopath or a violent person, that's a substantive support of a higher sentence. The other part about the discrepancy between sentences, the case of Davis shows that there's a spectrum. So in our reply, we look at Pugliese Rosario, where there's multiple year discrepancy. The government has bargained to maintain the ability to ask for a much higher sentence and submit additional aggravating material. Davis points out that it describes a 60-month difference as a significant discrepancy. So I think, I wasn't here for the other argument, 12 months in prison, I think is a different context if someone is describing to Your Honor, well, this is a significant upward variance. But in terms of the room that the government has to make a good faith recommendation, I think that should be covered by the requirement that the government has to abide by the most meticulous standards of promise and performance. And once this court assesses the context of the case, if those aren't complied with, then there's been a breach. There's nothing further on.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, counsel for the government, please introduce himself on the record to begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. At USA, Eileen Giovanni Mercado, appearing on behalf of the United States. If it pleases the court, we ask that this honorable court affirm the lower court because the parties entered into a plea agreement that contemplated very expressly a sentencing range, and the government offered reasons to support that range. And
what,
so,
what was the sentencing range?
It was 37 months on the low end to 46 months on the higher end, Your Honor, and that's at Appellant's Appendix 39.
Okay, so a difference of 9 months.
Different than 9 months for the sentencing. And then there's also a 6-month gap between low end of 24 months and high end of 30 months for the revocation proceeding. And so, Your Honor, given the fact that the plea agreement expressly incorporated a split sentencing recommendation, the government offered reasons in support of a sentence at the higher end, but also to foreclose a possible lower end sentence as well. Importantly, the plea agreement did not impose a limit on advocacy, which, as this court knows and has also explained in other opinions, it's definitely more art than science. And so the government submitted a sentencing memorandum that specifically recommended the upper end of the sentencing guidelines four separate times. Appellant's Appendix 53, 60, 65, and 66. And the content of the sentencing memo, not just related to the 3553 factors, but also to comply with the government's statutory obligation under 18 U.S.C. 3661.
Counsel, you're absolutely right that the government can, of course, advocate for the sentence that it's requesting, and there was a range here. But I was struck that your brief didn't actually include the specific words that the government used to the district court requesting the sentence. And so one of the words that your opposing counsel has highlighted is the government's argument that this was an exceptional case, and that the defendant likely participates in other criminal activity involving high capacity weapons of war. And I'm wondering if you can address, you know, in particular, the use of the word exceptional. Is that really not a term of art for asking for a sentence above the guideline range, for varying upward, not just for a sentence at the top of the range?
I think it can be, Your Honor, but I think it needs to be evaluated in the appropriate context, because in this case, although there was a use of the word exceptional, which of course the government can understand the court's concern, the conduct was exceptional in the sense that it was remarkable or that it was really bad, without that necessarily translating into a request for a variance.
But the thing is, if it is exceptional, then it suggests that the government's, the contract it made in the plea agreement was sort of, you know, didn't have the substance or the force of a real contract, because the government thought the case was really special.
To the contrary, Your Honor, I think the factors that the government presented in the sentencing memo were designed to demonstrate why a sentence at the higher end of the guidelines range was appropriate. And that was the type of advocacy that was included in the sentencing memorandum, because those photos were one reason of several other reasons that specifically relate to the defendant that's being sentenced. They relate to the history and characteristics of the defendant, who has a prior criminal history involving firearms and narcotics, and then while he was on supervised release, then possessed two loaded, fully automatic machine guns. They also, the sentencing memo, in addition, touched upon the offense conduct and the substantial risk to others present because of the defendant's own behavior. For example, not just possessing two loaded machine guns, but and small quantities of narcotics, but he abandoned those two fully loaded machine guns in a barbershop, in a public space, for anybody to come and grab them. And so, Your Honor, in addition to the defendant's criminal history and the specific offense conduct, the pictures really do kind of indicate, or at least corroborate, a certain pattern in the defendant's criminal history.
Even if we put the pictures aside, so let's say they weren't even part of this case, one thing that really struck me was the government statements about, and I don't have them right in front of me, but that this defendant was likely involved with a lot of other very serious criminal activity. And I, in terms of the defendant's breach argument, I think that's a factor you really have to wrestle with. Is there a way that we should think about that?
I think so, Your Honor. And I think the point that I was making is right on point with the question that you're raising, and that's the defendant's history combined with the offense conduct paint a picture of somebody who deals and engages with firearms, whether possessing, whether using, it's unclear. But the content from the phone, I think, demonstrates that there is a pattern of a firearm recidivism present in this particular case. And so the way that I would frame or try to
That's not what the government said.
Well, I think the way I would frame the pictures is too few pictures and they can be dismissed as a fluke, as an accident, as something that just happened to stumble upon the defendant's phone. By including enough pictures, that argument could not be made any longer, because there's just so many.
You agree that the specific words that the government chose to use matter, right? We're supposed to consider it the specific words used when we evaluate whether the agreement was breached, correct?
Of course, Your Honor.
So, just to turn to another issue, some of the images, and I understand your point that the government thought it was important to include enough images, so it doesn't seem like a fluke, but some of the images and the descriptions of what the images depicted, you know, did raise reliability concerns for me. For instance, the image, Snapchat photo, the panda image, and then what the government attorney did with that image, creating the arrow and suggesting that was the defendant. At least from what we can see in the appendix provided to us, it's very blurry. What was the basis for the government saying that that was actually an image of the defendant? My understanding is this is unanalyzed cell phone data.
So, Your Honor, in this case, I know the appellant has raised the issue of reliability, and the government does think that for purposes of the sentence and the government's conduct, that is a red herring, because at the same time, even though the photos came from the defendant's phone, the district court didn't actually consider any of the photos in imposing the sentence. There was no reference to them.
But that's
the
not
sentence.
Relevant for the breach claim, because if the plea agreement was breached by including those photos or including unreliable evidence, they don't need to show defendants that need to show prejudice. So can you try and just go back to my question? What was the basis for the government's attorney concluding that that was an image of the defendant? Because the image that I saw, granted it's, you know, Xerox, it's completely unclear who the person
is. And you're referring to the video specifically and not the photos. And so
it's
for the
image, right?
With the superimposed panda.
Yes.
So that's an actual video that was provided provided to defense more than a year before the sentencing hearing. And in the video, the superimposed panda actually is sort of removed from the face of the person holding what appears to be an assault style rifle. And so when the defendant is moving the face of the panda, kind of moves to the side, and you can see the individual's face in the video. Harder to see in a still photo, but in the video there was enough for the court to consider that video to be a reliable evidence that this person who resembles the defendant was in possession of an assault style rifle. And I will note, just sort of related to that point and the reliability of the photos that were also provided in the revocation proceeding, the government informed the court that the metadata for the cell phone content was produced to counsel more than 8 months before the sentencing on August 3rd, 2021, and also included the dates for the images in the video for defense counsel's reference. That's at appellant's appendix, page 462 and 463, lines 21 to 25 and 1 to 5. And also indicated that, for example, the video was taken shortly before the defendant was arrested, and that was communicated to defense and also to the court at the revocation proceeding.
I understand that you provided the information, but again, I'm just going back to what is the government's basis. The government wants to provide reliable evidence to the court. My understanding is this is unanalyzed cell phone data, so it's just an attorney looked at it and decided it looked close enough to the defendant. Is that the answer?
Well, Your Honor, I think the video needs to be taken in the broader context that we've been talking about, not just the pattern of the conduct, firearm recidivism, the individual deterrence, and all the different factors that go into sentencing a particular defendant. This video was one component, sort of a broader picture that the government was creating or presenting to as part of its ability to offer reasons in support of a higher sentencing range. And so
I'm asking something much narrower.
Yeah.
Was this analyzed in any way, or did just an attorney look at it and conclude that the information was reliable enough based on just the attorney looking at it?
So when if you're referring to analysis, the content from the cell phone that was seized on the defendant's person was extracted by federal agents, mm-hmm. and the content was provided to the defense in full for them to be able to look at it, analyze it, have questions, have conversations about it. And not more than a year before the hearing. And so the photos, the video, everything was provided with metadata to the defense, and there were really no conversations about it. And so to the extent that it was extracted using a formal method from the device and then shared with defense counsel more than a year before the sentencing hearing, and then also reviewed by the government, and to determine that particular video, when viewed as a video as opposed to a still image, demonstrate somebody resembling the defendant. And I think part of the government's message in the sentencing memorandum is that it appears to be the defendant, because although it appears clear to the government, wanted to be sure that sort of that language is couched in some kind of prefatory language so that it's not communicated that this is 100% the defendant. But given how the video was extracted, given the multiple people that looked at it, and really the fact that the individual really does resemble the defendant, that was conveyed to the court as part of a broader sentencing memo.
I have a different question.
Sure.
Your brief points to sources that the government argues support the court's claims about the dangerousness of altered machine guns or modified machine guns, but there are no sources in the record below. The court didn't offer any substantive support for that. How are we to know that the court relied on evidence in terms of the dangerousness of modified machine guns that have a sufficient indicia of reliability in a case like this?
So if Your Honor is sort of referring to the Kimbrough portion of the analysis, you're right that the court did reference the machine gun's dangerousness and also its difficulty to control. And that information really does come from not just public sources, because I think there are several cases that have discussed the dangerousness of homemade machine guns, but also common sense, because if someone is taking what's designed to operate in a semi-automatic fashion and then at home modifying it and tweaking it to be able to expel as many bullets as are in the magazine at one time, that there's sort of a common sense implication that it may backfire, it may not work properly, it may explode in your hand, as I found out recently. And so I think just given the inherent dangerousness associated with building a machine gun in your house, I think a lot of that is either common sense or available in other cases that discuss these types of machine guns.
Good, but not here, but not available here in this record, as far as we can tell. Okay, thank you.
If there are no other questions, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, counsel for the appellant would please reintroduce himself on the record. He has a 2-minute rebuttal.
Good morning once again. Kevin Lerman on behalf of Diabia Mojica Ramos. I would like to make just 3 points briefly. The first is, as we noted in our reply, the government in their brief and now in argument doesn't deny that their advocacy failed the court's impartial observer test. And so I think that issue's resolved. I would like to point out, I think I made the point in Rosa Juarez, but the plea agreement here was for a recommendation within the guideline range. There wasn't a stipulation of criminal history points, so that range now is reduced to 33 to 41 months after November 1st from Amendment 821, which is retroactive and should be retroactive on appeal as well. Second point.
So you're asking us to apply that now?
Yes, Your Honor, and my apologies, I will submit a 28-J to that extent. An amendment is retroactive if it's clarifying and not substantive, and this clarifies when a person's status as being on supervised release, probation, some quote-unquote criminal justice sentence is an aggravator, and so that should be applied retroactive in this court's overall.
The commission declared retroactive.
It did, Your Honor, but that declaration applies under 3582 C2, so it is retroactive on direct appeal as well. Briefly, the modified gun allegation, it's not even consistent with what the court's pronouncement is, where the court quotes United States versus Henry from the Ninth Circuit that it can conceive of nothing more dangerous short of bombs and missiles and that sort of thing. So it's not a fact. There's two reasons why it's not a basis for a sentence. One, it's not a fact that's reasonably not contemplated in the guideline, and two, it originates outside the record. Most recently, this court in Navarro San Esteban provided that analysis. I'm out of time for the third point. We ask the court to vacate the both sentences and remand with a remedy that's in the interest of justice, which would be ideally one that will resolve this case finally, and that's why we ask that sentences within the guideline range be.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes argument in this case.